Okay, counsel, can you see Justice Miller Lerman? Happily, okay, very good. With that, Mr. Becker, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Appellant Natasha Carrizales requests that this court reverse the order granting summary judgment to what we've characterized in our brief as the doctors, which are three doctors that rendered her treatment on the day of the delivery of her child, as well as a reversal of the finding dismissing Creighton University predicated upon the conclusion that they were not served within 6 months of the date of filing. As it relates to the issue of service on Creighton University, a precipice seeking service upon Creighton University was filed within 6 months in April 2014. Then 10 days of the issuance of that summons based upon that April 2014 summons, a certified mailing with a summons and a copy of the complaint was served upon Creighton University care of its registered agent, James Jansen.
Mr. Becker, as a matter of fact, do you quarrel with the factual finding? I'm not implying anything about what it means. I just want to be clear about the facts that the summons that was actually served by certified mail in April 2014 was in fact the summons that had been issued originally in October 2013.
Yes, sir. I do quarrel with that. The affidavit in Exhibit 71, as well as Exhibit 69, indicates that the summons was served within 10 days of the issuance in April 2014. What occurred, under my belief, and again, we don't have anything from Creighton saying what we received, what I believe occurred was that the return, because Creighton, the clerk indicated in the summons in April 2014, the Presby was asking for service on Creighton University, care of James Jansen. The clerk, I believe, typed in the words Creighton University Medical or Creighton University Medical Center. The secretary who filed the return of service used the service return that was in the file that clearly identified Creighton University James Jansen consistent with the precipice. So my belief is that the summons that was sought within that 10 days is the one that was served upon Mr. Jansen. It's one or the other. But in either way, there is a summons identifying Creighton University as a defendant and a suit identifying Creighton University as a defendant that was served within 6 months upon Creighton University.
When you say it's one or the other, it's either what or what?
It is either that there is some chance, I will acknowledge it's possible, that the October summons to Creighton University was the one served. But because of my verms in the affidavit and what I think the only facts are, because Creighton University offers nothing, I think what it is because I've attested that what I would have done was within 10 days receipt of that precipice, along with all the other precipices that were obtained within that 10 days and served upon Dr. Gray, Dr. Arms, all the other defendants in that time frame, just as all those other defendants received their summons within 10 days of the issuance, I think it was that same summons. The difficulty, I think, arose when the secretary filed it and used the wrong service return because she was looking for the one that matched the certified mail receipt, which said Creighton University care of James Jansen. And the one the clerk had issued, because I think they were just copy and pasted, said Creighton University Medical or Creighton University Medical Center.
Now let's, at least I'm assuming if it was actually the April summons that was served, no problem, move on. But let's assume for a moment it was the October summons that was actually served. What's the legal effect of that and why?
The legal effect is that gives Creighton University the opportunity to come in under 12B4 or 12B5 and move to quash service because of some defect in the summons or in the service methodology. They did not do that. The only filing by Creighton University, because they clearly got it, was they filed a motion to strike later, and the same counsel for the doctors appeared in the case on behalf of Creighton University. It's indisputable that they received a summons and a copy of the lawsuit and never answered. I think they rolled the dice, as I said in my complaint, and just took the position, well, there's some defect in the summons, so we don't have to answer. But I would respectfully submit that's why 12B4 and 12B5 exist, because if you have an issue with the summons, come in and make that argument. And if you don't do it on a timely basis, then it's waived.
What do we do about 25217's reference to proper service. I mean, 25217 says if the defendant has to be properly served within 180 days, and if they're not, they're dismissed by operation of law. So how do we give effect to properly?
I think properly requires service of a summons and the complaint. If you don't serve a complaint, or you don't serve it via certified mail, or you don't serve it via sheriff or one of the methodized recognized of delivery, like if you just send it via US mail, I would submit that that's not proper service. But when you utilize a method allowed for under the rules of service, I think that's proper service. It's modifying the term service. I think the service is either the certified mail, the sheriff delivery, a recognized methodology of service.
So it's your contention that the service of a stale summons can nevertheless be proper?
Yes, because and that's the cases I cite in my brief, that if there is a defect with that summons, it's incumbent upon the party to come in and move to say, hey, there is some defect with the summons. That's why you have 12B4, 12B5. There is some insufficiency of this service of process. That would have been the opportunity to say, hey, I got a stale summons. Or, hey, there's an additional word, medical or medical center, on my summons. There's some problem with the summons that somehow renders service improper. That's why you have the insufficiency of service argument under 12B4 and 12B5. They didn't make that assertion. I think under the record before this court, there is certainly ample evidence to conclude there is service upon Creighton University within the 6 months. They did not challenge that service in a timely manner. I don't think you then can make the leap and say this case was dismissed by operation of law. The other argument laid out in our brief is that there was a striking of the expert witness, Fred DeBow. No deposition notice was ever issued upon him. No subpoena was ever issued upon him. The record reflects that after there was this order to compelling his deposition to occur within a time frame, dates were offered. There are two recognized dates offered in an email to me to opposing counsel. In response, there is no subpoena. There's no deposition notice. They didn't take action to effectuate to acquire jurisdiction over Dr. Fred DeBow. Instead, they came in and said, well, he wasn't deposed in time, and therefore strike him. And therefore, we'll then get summary judgment because we're just going to offer the affidavit of Dr. Gray to justify summary judgment.
What is our standard of review on that issue?
I think it's de novo, Your Honor. That's a question of law. And I think that simply put, there was never jurisdiction over Dr. DeBow to strike his testimony or make that ruling because the court never acquired jurisdiction by a deposition notice was disregarded or a subpoena that was disregarded. You have to take some action to get jurisdiction over the party that you want to strike his testimony. And significantly, we did the exact same thing to Dr. Gray. We deposed Dr. Gray. She said, I'm not going to offer opinions on causality in this case. I haven't reviewed the medical records. In her answers to the interrogatory, she's not identified as an expert witness for any of the defendants. And yet they predicate their summary judgment solely upon Dr. Gray's testimony. She then comes in and says, well, now I've read the medical records, even though she said, I'm not going to provide any opinions. I submit that there's an inconsistency there, saying, we're going to strike Dr. DeBow's testimony, who says, I reviewed the medical records, I'm familiar with the standard of care, because he didn't appear for a deposition, even though we never noticed him, never subpoenaed him. Dr. Gray, who was noticed, said, I'm not going to provide any opinions. And then they come in on summary judgment and utilize her as the sole basis of their motion for summary judgment. I submit that that's improper. I respectfully request to use the remainder of my time as rebuttal.
You may. Ms. Schock, good morning to you.
Good morning. Please, court, counsel. First, I will address the issue of the service. I don't believe that you have proper service if you serve an expired summons. I think the rules are pretty clear. You have to serve it within 10 days. And I want to point out that counsel has said, well, there's an extra word in the precipe or the return. Well, it's not an extra word. Creighton University is the defendant at issue, and the entity was Creighton University Medical Center. That's a completely different entity, and not only that, it was a co-defendant. So by serving Creighton University Medical Center, all they did was reserve a co-defendant. And that doesn't mean that Creighton University has to somehow discern that they were the intended defendant and file a 12B motion challenging service. And under 25217, after 6 months, the case is dismissed by operation of law. And that's what happened here. If that happens, whether or not the 12B motion was filed, but to even know to file the 12B motion, Creighton would have to know it had been served. And there's nothing indicating that it was. And the first summons that was issued, the 226-226, when you get a summons, you flip it over and the service returns on the back. And that's what counsel filled out. And counsel also filled out the proof of service, proof that they served Creighton University Medical Center, which again, it's just more establishing that they've reserved a defendant. And Judge Gleason knew that. He overruled the motion for default judgment because there was no service. And I think that was a proper result. And we'd ask that that be affirmed.
Opposing counsel argues that properly in 25217 refers to the use of a, I think I'm paraphrasing this correctly, use of a recognized method or a statutorily authorized method. What is your understanding of what properly refers to in 25217?
I think that opposing counsel's reading is way too narrow. It doesn't say you have to serve it using one of these methods. They have to be properly served. And I think that would be understood as not serving the wrong party, not serving an expired summons. It would include using recognized method of service like certified mail, but I don't think it ends there. And as far as the summary judgment, defendants made a great deal of effort for a very long time to depose Dr. Dubow. And
Dr. Dubow, your opponent referred to him as a party. He wasn't a party, was he?
He was not.
A witness, right?
Correct. He was the plaintiff's retained expert witness. And we attempted to depose him, and we did what everybody does, which is try and arrange a date. He did live in Illinois, but this is the plaintiff's expert, and we should be able to depose him.
I beg your pardon. What steps precisely were taken to depose Dr. Dubow?
There were multiple requests for dates and times when he would be available.
Was this in correspondence with opposing counsel, subpoenas, emails directly to the expert? I beg your pardon, more precisely. Thank you.
It was correspondence with plaintiff's counsel. At one point, we even offered to contact the expert and set it up ourselves. It's not common for one party to contact the other side's expert to arrange their deposition. Since they want to call the person, it's incumbent on them to produce them to comply with the discovery process.
And I beg your pardon, is there anything in the Uniform Interstate Act that is relevant to this discussion on how to get an out-of-state expert's opinion?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think that that would apply to a fact witness, if it had been a nurse standing there that witnessed something. But we don't need, the court doesn't need jurisdiction over Dr. Dubow. The court has jurisdiction over the party. And the party is named an expert, and they need to comply with the discovery process with that expert. It's not incumbent on the defendant to file an out-of-state subpoena. The plaintiff wants to present this testimony, and they have to.
What did the plaintiff fail to comply with?
What they didn't do was allow the defendants to depose the expert, at which point we went to the court for assistance.
I beg your pardon. Can an expert appear in a summary judgment matter exclusively by, say, affidavit?
Yes, in a summary judgment, that's almost exclusively how it's done. The expert would just submit the affidavit of their opinions, and the other side would submit their expert's affidavit generally. The problem here was that Dr. DuBose had already been stricken when he submitted his affidavit.
Can we return to, with what did the plaintiff fail to comply with respect to Dr. DuBose's deposition?
So ultimately, it was the order of the court.
So the court's order says within 2 weeks, provide dates.
Yes.
Did they do that?
No.
And how did they, in what respect did they fail to provide, did plaintiffs fail to provide dates?
There were communications trying to set up dates. There were co-defendants at the time. So there was the Doctors' Council, Creighton University Medical Center's Council, Mr. Becker, and the doctor. And we tried to find dates when he would be available.
What prevented the defendants from noticing the deposition using one of the dates, one of the multiple dates that were provided during that 2 month timeframe?
Nothing prevented it, Your Honor, but I don't think the law generally requires parties to do things that are futile.
Well, the plaintiff couldn't notice it for you.
No, but if someone throws out a date and it doesn't work for everybody, then you wouldn't go ahead and notice in a deposition when you know the witness isn't available or counsel isn't available. It really seems like an exercise in futility, which is why parties get together and provide dates and agree and find a time.
Mr. Becker indicated there were at least two dates that were made available after the judge's order to compel. Were those 2 days, is that accurate? Were those 2 dates didn't work for the other parties? What's the issue with those 2 dates?
I can't tell you specifically, but I can tell you that we were actively trying to schedule this deposition, so somebody wasn't available or we would have taken it. There in no way were the defendants trying to get around the order and get this expert stricken.
Is that information in our record? What the reasoning was?
What is in the record is that Judge Gleason entered an order saying you have 2 months to get this done. And it wasn't done. And we went back to the court and the court enforced its order.
But did you inform the court why the 2 days that he offered didn't work?
I don't know if it was that specific.
Were the affidavits and the emails offered at the time of that hearing?
Yes, I believe they were.
In a medical malpractice case, isn't the striking of the plaintiff's expert witness basically the death knell of the case? I mean, isn't it over?
Well, in this case, it was. I would agree that generally that is what happens.
So when we analyze a sanction for failing to comply with a court order, you know, sort of a sliding scale from a light sanction to a heavy sanction. So this is a pretty heavy sanction, isn't it, in this case?
It is. But the other thing to consider is this case was filed in October of 2013. And this expert was stricken in June of 2018. That's just an exceptionally long time, I believe, to not be able to progress the case. And the court was clearly aware of that. We had started in March of 2016 to try to depose this expert, and the motion to strike wasn't filed until September of 2017, which was a long time.
I think I heard your opponent say that we would review the striking of the expert de novo. Do you agree with that?
I disagree. It's a court's ruling on discovery, which is reviewed for abuse of discretion.
Thank you. I think your time is up.
If there are no more questions.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? 1 minute and 10 seconds, Mr. Becker.
Thank you. Your Honors, among other locations, Exhibit 35 indicates dates offered to the defendants for deposition, including back in September of 2017, where we offered October 11th, and the correspondence from the counsel for the appellees indicates, well, October 10th works for me. Go ahead and tell Dr. DeBeau to keep that date open. However, I want to wait and see what happens with our hearing on October 3rd.
Mr. Becker, did the district court judge give any indication why he gave this rather severe penalty to you for?
He just indicated that, well, I told you to have him deposed by a time period and he wasn't deposed, so he's stricken. But in my Exhibit 35 also indicates we offered October 23rd to October 25th. Another communication indicates October 11th became available. I indicated other dates the doctor has offered, but I assume are too far out, are April 30th, May 15th, May 16th, May 21st, May 22nd. Multiple dates were offered. Where I get to the de novo review is, I don't think that there's jurisdiction for the court to strike the testimony of Dr. DeBeau because he didn't disregard a deposition or subpoena. We offered dates. He's technically beyond our control because he is not a party. And if I said party, that's obviously I misspoke. He's not a party. To get jurisdiction over that non-party, you have to issue a subpoena or deposition notice. And the court, Justice Papik is correct. This is the death knell. It's an extreme remedy. And when they sit there and say, well, we waited a long time, look at the time periods Judge Gleason sat on orders in this case. There were literally orders that sat for over a year time period. And then he's going to strike the expert and kill this case because the expert's not deposed within a 2 month time period, even though he takes a year to rule on motions.
Did the judge tell you in his motion to compel that if this is not completed within 2 months, the witness will be stricken? Was there any indications or warnings that this may happen?
I think there, I'm not, I don't recollect the verbiage order, but I think there is something to that effect about get it done within 2 months. We proposed dates within those 2 months. They didn't issue a notice or a subpoena. Just like October 10th was made available before their first motion to strike, they had a date, they didn't exercise it, they went forward with their motion. I just think it's improper. And then finally, on the service, look to the case of Gandy versus Jolly cited in our brief, which says, if there's irregularity in process, the defendant must take advantage of some irregularity by motion or proceeding. The certified mail shows it went to Creighton University, care of James Jansen, the registered agent. He's not the registered agent for Creighton University Medical Center. They got a summons, they got a complaint, they knew they were sued. If they thought there was some defect, it was incumbent upon them under the case law to come utilize the motion process to bring that to the court's attention. Under the record before this court, which says summons was served within 10 days, and we have the certified mail receipt on their agent, the evidence before the court, because there's nothing from Creighton, there's supposition by the judge, only supposition, but the evidence before the court is that there was proper service because there was service of a summons and a complaint within 10 days. That was enough to acquire jurisdiction. If there was any further complaint, it was incumbent upon them under the case law and the motion, the rule process to bring a motion. They didn't do so. We respectfully request the court to reverse.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments on Carrizales versus Creighton St. Joseph Regional Healthcare System, LLC. Counsel, you are excused, and the court will go on to the next case of the day, which is Garrison versus Autumn.